Good morning. So last time we finished up graphs and we talked about missing pieces of implementing Kruskal's algorithm. We said we wanted to have an efficient way of detecting whether if we added an edge to our incomplete spanning tree, that would make it not a spanning tree, not a tree at all, make it have a cycle. So we have this union find data structure, which was based on the idea that we'd track sets of vertices, and we'd name each set by some designated vertex. And we have this union operation where we just have a data structure where you connect one designated vertex to another in order to combine the two sets rather than having to iterate through all the vertices and relabel each one separately. We just have this indirection for our label where we first go to one vertex and then we find out, oh, that label changed to another and use that. We also briefly talked about a relationship between minimum spanning tree and traveling salesman, especially under this special case for traveling salesman where we assume that if you go directly from A to C, that's going to be shorter than going from A to B to C. This is not actually required by the problem definition, but many of the interesting cases where you care about something like traveling salesman, it's true. And we have these two bounds which helped us make that useful. So one is that we observed that the traveling salesperson problem weight would be bigger than the minimum spanning tree weight because, well, if we take a TSP tour, remove an edge, it's a spanning tree. It's probably not the minimum one, but it's a spanning tree. And that we could also construct a tour from a minimum spanning tree by just traversing it, using a pre-order traversal that you've implemented, and we could bound the weight of that tour to be within a certain factor of the minimum spanning tree weight.
What kind of traversal? Did you say in-order or pre-order?
We said pre-order. It doesn't actually matter. Because I did pre-order, for example, but like it doesn't matter because you just still go through the tree, and as long as you use every edge twice, you have that bound. So then we moved on to our next topic, which is about memory. So we talked about what memory layout looks like. We have our stack and heap that we alluded to earlier. We mentioned that they grow towards each other. We mentioned that, well, when you're writing a program, you're not seeing the real memory layout of the machine. There's this address translation going on where the operating system decides what memory is accessible to you and what memory addresses those have. And it does it by setting up this mapping between your program's memory addresses and the real memory addresses on the underlying hardware. And this allows us to have multiple programs running which use the same memory addresses. This allows us to decide that, our code is always at this address, even if I'm writing multiple copies of the same program or multiple copies of different programs with different code at that same address, it can still work. We start talking about memory allocation. So I mentioned a weird memory allocation function which allocated memory on the stack, where we just update our stack pointer, and that's how we'd allocate memory. And this would have the same attributes as like a local variable allocation, but could be dynamically sized. You just pass an argument to a function. And we looked at what an old implementation of that would look like and mentioned that, well, in these days, we probably need the compiler's help because there are things we don't know about how the function's using the stack. And then we started looking at malloc, which was the C allocation interface, which I think you've used a little bit in some lab. And we talked about the relationship between an interface like the malloc one, where we supply a size and we have a free function, and operator new and delete in C++, where operator new and operator delete actually have two components. They handle the memory allocation and deallocation, and they also handle constructors and destructors. And we mentioned that those are things that you can, if you want to, do separately. An example of a case where you'd want to do that is if you say we're implementing your own vector. You want to actually decide when things are constructed separately from allocating your big dynamic array to put them in. So any questions about these topics from before? Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about implementing things like malloc or the memory allocation part of operator new. And your naive thought, which, you know, it seems like the logical thing, is that, well, I told you that we have this mapping set by the OS between different types of addresses, and the OS can adjust this. So you might say, okay, so malloc is just going to ask the OS for memory. And free is just going to tell the OS, I'm done using memory. The OS is going to update this mapping. And that would work, but this is not typically what a malloc implementation looks like. And the issue is with what that mapping looks like and its granularity. So the mapping on a typical modern processor works in these 4 kilobyte, what are called pages. So these are 4 kilobyte units of memory. That's the minimum size the OS can allocate or deallocate. And when you call malloc or new, you're very often allocating something which isn't some multiple of 4 kilobytes, it's even close. Like if we're doing like a 16 byte allocation, we don't want to waste 4 kilobytes on that. But the OS, because of the way the mapping typically works, that's its only option. It can give you 4 more kilobytes or it can take away 4 kilobytes. That's all it can really do. Also, updating that mapping has a relatively high performance cost. So it's order microseconds. Measuring the performance cost is tricky, which is why I don't have exact numbers. Like, it's tricky in the sense that updating the mapping affects the performance in a way other than just the amount of time between when you update the mapping and when you return to the program. There's other costs. But it's order microseconds for each time you would do an allocation or free by updating that mapping. And our malloc new implementation, so we want to really support these small allocations. If you look at many real programs, they often do these 16 byte or 32 byte or like even smaller allocations all the time. And the performance we expect is something like, you know, order 100 nanoseconds per allocation, which is faster than our OS can do by updating this mapping. So the big job of malloc and new is to sort of batch all these small allocations and to make big requests. So malloc is going to request, you know, 16K or 32K of memory and use that to satisfy your hundreds of linked list node allocations for all these little pieces of memory. And this is going to make your program a lot faster because we're not going to contact the OS and spend a couple microseconds updating that mapping each time you ask for a new list node. And it's going to make it use a lot less memory because we're not going to allocate 4K for each of your, you know, 32 byte list nodes. So the general pattern is that a malloc implementation or operator new allocator implementation, it's going to get this large allocation from the OS, and it's going to have to subdivide it, and that means it needs to have some sort of data structure. And there are two big ideas for how to implement that data structure, because the big question is, well, I'm writing a data structure to keep track of allocations. How do I allocate space for that data structure? And there are two common answers that are used. So one idea is that you get this big chunk of memory, and you're just going to use pieces of that memory around what you return to the user to keep track of what you return to the user. So you like have some stuff before or after each allocation indicating, you know, where it is relative to other allocations and so on. Another idea is that you could allocate a completely separate region of memory to track this. Like you could have a hash table mapping addresses you've allocated to information about their size and things next to them and so on. And implementing malloc and free has all these really tricky choices. So one tricky choice that they have is, well, you know, so I've allocated a bunch of memory, I've subdivided my allocation. What's going to happen if I have lots of little free chunks? Like, let's say you allocated 100 linked list nodes, you freed 50 of them, and now you ask me for like 500 bytes. And it might be the case that I look at my allocation, and if I didn't do things right, I end up not having 500 bytes I can give you, even though I have all these linked list nodes that are freed, which total up well more than 500 bytes. So that's like one challenge that malloc implementations have to deal with, is somehow trying to make that problem not happen too often, you know, and figuring out how to deal with it when it does. Another question is, well, you know, you asked me for 500 bytes, you know, and you've allocated all sorts of different sizes and freed all sorts of different sizes. What sort of data structure design do I use to quickly find a chunk of the right size? That is, that I've you know, already asked the OS for, it's already part of what I got. How do I find that I have a subdivided part which is a particular size quickly? So we're not gonna go into too much detail about strategies for this, but this is like, there's lots of trade-offs here, and you know, different operating systems have different standard libraries with different implementations, and sometimes you'll find people using their own implementation of malloc, and it's usually because they have different ideas about these choices than the operating systems that they otherwise they'd be using the libraries from. But to give you a better idea of what this sort of data structures might look like, I'm going to show you an example of a common implementation technique that's based around the idea of, you know, I have this large allocation, and I'm going to put some stuff around what I return to the user. So when you call malloc, I'm going to have some stuff, in this case, just before what I return to you, which helps me keep track of how I've subdivided this big region of memory I got from the operating system itself. And one thing we could imagine doing is that we have this little struct here, and I have a size, so I need to know the size of my allocation. You call free, you don't tell me how big it is. So I need to track the size, and yeah, I guess that should be for, and for, I should say, unallocated pieces. And I have a list for free space, I guess for, this is for free, of the previous and next chunk of memory. So a common technique is that we have a linked list of these pieces of memory here. So I have free space here and free space here, and these are part of a linked list. And when I want to find a chunk, I just scan that linked list until I find one of the right size. So that's how my malloc works. My malloc, there's some pointer somewhere in memory to, you know, first free, and I just scan the linked list starting with from there until I find a chunk of the appropriate size, and then I remove it from this linked list of free chunks of memory. And when you call free, I say, okay, you have this object here that you used, and I'm going to just say, okay, I know its size, so I can use its size to find where the next object starts, because this distance is size. And based on that, I can also figure out where, you know, from the list, I can figure out, or some other data structure, I can eventually figure out where this chunk starts, and I can merge them all together into one big chunk. So this is a common sort of strategy that we have a linked list of these available chunks of memory, that we keep track of the size before we have the allocations, before the allocation, so when we free, we can find the next thing in memory and possibly merge two chunks together without having to scan all of our list of free items to find what's just before it. And, you know, we hopefully merge these chunks together. We keep track of enough data. We might need a little more information than I'm showing you to do this efficiently. But we merge these together and we get these bigger free chunks. So this is how we can satisfy large allocations, hopefully without having to go back to the OS, assuming that we don't have the problem of having like only little free spaces. So any questions about this idea? As I said, there's lots of tough choices here. So one, you know, quickly finding blocks with the right free sizes. Avoiding large amounts of free spaces, small free spaces. So, and you know, worrying about how much extra overhead, because I had size next and previous. We might want also the size of the previous thing so we can merge those chunks more efficiently. But then I'm wasting more space in an allocation that's not being used for your like linked list nodes. You know, like here we have like a second linked list we're storing. And there's, you know, various solutions to this. So one way of avoiding large amounts of free spaces, one idea is, you know, one region for each size. You know, like if you have one area of memory for each size of allocation, you're less likely to have like big little chunks mixed with big chunks, and that can help with that. But obviously that might mean you waste more space because, you know, I asked to allocate a larger size and you won't use some free memory you already have. You want to quickly find blocks of the right size. You might have different free lists for different sizes is one way of doing that. And then there's the question of how many of those do you have? You know, how do you deal with the case where the free list for, you know, around 500 bytes is empty, but the one for 1,000 isn't? Like, how do you check all those? And there's also questions of what do you do when you scan this free list? Do you just return the first thing you find? Do you try to find the best, you know, the one which wastes the least space to avoid making big chunks of free memory? Or what? And so these are all choices which people generally, when they are making malloc implementations, they test empirically which of these work out best. So like they take a program and they benchmark it, they say, okay, which one of these has the best performance, wastes the least space, and that's how they make these choices. Because for all of these, you can like construct programs which allocate memory in a way which makes pretty much any malloc implementation look bad or look really good. So any questions about sort of this high level view of what we can do when implementing malloc? Okay. So since we've talked a little bit about implementing malloc, I'd like to talk about the one missing function from the allocation functions that exist in C, which is realloc. So realloc, redoes an allocation, is sort of where the name comes from. And it's kind of a strange function because it does one of two things. So either it changes the size of the allocation at the pointer you pass it. That's usually how people think of it, is that, oh, I have some array, I want to change its size, I'm going to call realloc. Or it allocates a new space, copies the data that you have previously allocated to that new space, and then frees the old space. And it returns the new space, or if you didn't allocate new space, just the original pointer. So there are two sorts of modes. So we have the change the size mode, where, you know, these boxes represent our allocation, and the red box represents the actual thing we're dealing with, it just changes the size. And that's going to work when the malloc implementation looks at this data structure, it says, oh, there's some free space right after this, I can just use some of that. So like it looks at its size, checks what's at the next thing, what's chunks next, finds out that it's actually not used, and takes advantage of that. Another thing it might have to do is it might want to make the size so that it can't change the size. So in that case, it's going to first allocate a new space, and then it's going to copy the data you had in your allocation to that new space, and then free the old space and return the new space. And I'm mentioning this so explicitly because a very common mistake with realloc is to not use the return value. And it's a really subtle error because usually it's going to work out fine. Because usually this will happen. But sometimes you're asking for a little too much. You know, you got unlucky and this will happen and now you'll have a pointer up here. And that's going to work great until you start modifying the memory of this region, in which case you'll have some really subtle bug. Yeah, so that's the big gotcha, is you have to use the return value. The other big gotcha is that in addition to using the return value, if you like have other pointers to the array, like you have to worry about them too. Which is another thing people commonly forget. Again, because in the good case, the size just changes and nothing moves, but that can't always happen just because you didn't ask malloc in advance for enough memory. So it might have used the space right after what you allocated. And realloc sort of has this different efficiency. So if you have to copy, realloc's worst case is linear time. So in the worst case, it has to actually copy all the data. And ideally, it's just constant time. All it's doing is updating these data structures that malloc uses. So that was my brief talk about new and delete. So there's another topic with memory that's related to this idea that we have these multiple layers here. So, and this is with the hardware implementation instead of, in this case, the software implementation. So we think of memory as, well, it's this big thing that's outside our processor that our processor always talks to, you know, that can store on a modern machine many gigabytes of data. But it turns out that if we just naturally used something outside our processor that stored gigabytes of data, we would not be happy with our program's performance. So instead, our processors have caches, which are smaller versions of the memory, you know, which store a subset of the data, but are much faster. And in fact, if you look at a processor at any time in the past several decades, most of the space is dedicated to caches. So here's a die photograph of a 2004 CPU. I'm using a 2004 CPU because I know where the registers are in this, and it's hard to figure that out for a more modern CPU. And I know because someone else figured it out, not that I can actually read die photos. So this red region here is about where the registers on this processor are. There's both floating point and integer registers. And this area here is the L1 cache. So this is the first level. That's what that stands for. L1 is level one. So cache. So those are the level one caches. And this is where, ideally, most memory accesses go. So hopefully, this is where, you know, 90%+ of memory accesses stop here in these L1 caches. So even though we have this giant memory, well, relatively speaking, well, it's like this big off the chip, hopefully most of our memory accesses use these caches. And this is a die, you know, electron micrograph. So like this whole chip is like millimeters in diameter. So these are really small. Millimeters, sort of several, you know, millimeters across. Okay. And then we have an L2 cache, which is that region I've highlighted in yellow. That's the level 2 cache. So hopefully most of the stuff that doesn't end up being in the level 1 cache is in the level 2 cache. And so the idea is that almost all our memory accesses actually stay on this physical chip, this little thing, and that makes them a lot faster. And on a more recent processor, they would have this level 1 and level 2 cache, and this whole thing would be smaller. And they'd also have a level 3 cache, which would take up a similar portion of the CPU. So this is a single core CPU, and you can think of like a more recent processor has something like this for each core. And then a level 3 cache that's usually shared between all the cores and is similarly large compared to the overall package. So we're devoting most of our space to these caches, which are just trying to substitute for our memory because they're closer to the CPU and it ends up faster. And this is most of our space. And a thing about modern CPUs is that, well, you'd think, you know, it's a processor, so we're going to have most of our space dedicated to, like, arithmetic, multiplication, division. So this area here is where, and this area here is where all the stuff dedicated to arithmetic is. Everything else in the processor is either dedicated to handling memory accesses or handling loading, storing instructions. Loading instructions, decoding instructions, and so on. Like a very small region of the processor actually does computation. And this is all true on modern processors too. So after we have the L3 cache, eventually we go off this chip to a main memory, which, you know, would not, you know, is many, many, many times bigger than this little processor die, this micrograph. And the benefit we're getting by having these alternate storage is one in performance. So the time to access our registers is like less than a nanosecond. If we have every instruction, we can easily access registers and we run many instructions, not many, but like 2 to 3-ish instructions per nanosecond on a modern processor. So, you know, we can access registers with a delay of less than a nanosecond. The L1 cache takes around about a nanosecond to access. The L2 cache on a typical processor is like 5. If there's an L3 cache on a processor, it's typically something like 20. And main memory is like something like 100. These numbers are approximate, like they can vary by like a factor of 2, but we still have this many orders of magnitude difference between the speed at which this small region here, and here, these small caches can be accessed, and our main memory, which is off-chip. And this is a lot just because of physics, like the caches are smaller, they're closer, speed of light says that they have to be faster, and we're talking about nanoseconds here. And so generally, when we actually have our memory, the way it really works is that we have a memory hierarchy. That when you have a variable that you write in your program, that it gets stored, ideally, in registers. Now, it gets stored in registers because hopefully your compiler figures out, oh, I can put this in a register. And that's the fastest storage that we have on our processors. And it's also the smallest. Like, you can't actually fit that much in registers. In x86, we learned that we had 16 of them. That's quite small. And then you have stuff which, in your assembly, is logically in memory. But this all gets stored in these caches. So we have levels of cache. And as we get to bigger and bigger levels of cache, they get bigger and slower. So the level one cache is pretty small, but it's quite fast. And the level three cache is bigger, but slower. And then you have main memory, which is very big, but relatively speaking, very slow. And we can also think of other forms of storage as part of this memory hierarchy. So like, if we run out of space in memory, we're going to use our hard drive or our SSD. That's much, much bigger than a typical memory. Like, I have, you know, 4-ish gigs of memory on a laptop. I probably have terabytes on hard drives or SSDs. Mini machines, like, that's a big gap. But the hard drives or SSDs are going to be way, way slower than memory. And what we see with these caches that we don't see with, say, registers, is that the use of this level of the memory hierarchy is implicit. So with, like, hard drives, usually you think that I explicitly put a file on my hard drive. You know, I say, store this file. With registers, if you think about the assembly, you explicitly say, I want to use this register. With caches, you don't say that. Caches, you pretend that you're using the main memory all the time. And the hope is that, well, you don't. That you use, actually, the L1 cache most of the time. And that it looks like you get the performance you get from the L1 cache, even though, well, obviously, you know, if you're accessing, like, a 100 megabyte array, it doesn't fit on that L1 cache. So the goal of the memory hierarchy, when it's providing this sort of implicit idea of using these levels of cache, is to, you know, make it look like that you can use the size of the largest storage, but get the speed of the smallest storage. And this is obviously impossible. Like, obviously, I'm going to be able to tell that I don't really have a, you know, 4 gigabyte memory that's as fast as my L1 cache. Like, that's something I don't have, and there's some program I can write where it's going to be obvious that that's not the case. But we can get pretty close due to this idea of locality. That we're going to rely on, you know, typical access patterns are going to be better. And we're going to be able to put the stuff that we actually care about based on what typical accesses to memory look like in the faster storage, even though that faster storage is very small. So we'll talk about locality in a bit. So first, let's look over, you know, what some numbers are sort of on a modern system. So I showed you sort of the picture of, you know, some old processor and approximate numbers. To make it really concrete, here are the numbers on my desktop or a system very much like it. Note that we have two different numbers here. So something which is not so obvious is that there's a big difference between the scale of the time per access, so if I know I want to get something, how long it takes to get it, versus the maximum speed to read, because I can read like a large chunk at once. This is especially true for like a hard drive, where I can read a lot of the, you know, it takes me about 5 milliseconds to get something, but, you know, when I'm getting something, I can get like a megabyte of stuff. But we still have this big gap going all the way up. So, mentioned our caches. So our caches are gonna work to try to hide this latency of main memory. And the way they're gonna do it is by storing values that were recently accessed or values that were near recently accessed. And the idea is the program tries to access main memory, and most accesses take the shortcut to the cache. And our key assumption, which is this locality idea, is that most values the program is going to try to access are going to be these recently accessed values or near recently accessed values. So by keeping those in the cache, we'll get good performance. And caches are a real observable thing on your processor. So typically, you don't notice their effects, but if you want to see what they do, you can do that. So I wrote, for example, a program that accesses an array in random order. And I did this in a way where I stored in the array the index of the next thing to access, and I constructed the order by, you know, making an array of numbers randomly sorted and then adjusting it to have array indices. So by accessing in a random order, I defeat this idea of what the cache is trying to do. So, you know, I have the caches keeping recently accessed values, values near recently accessed values. I access an array in a random order, and I'm just going to get, you know, it's not going to help me. So depending on how big my array is, I get to see whether or not it fits in the cache. And I did these accesses several times over and over again. So when the array was small enough to fit in the cache, it did. And you can see sort of this dramatic effect from the sizes of the cache on the system I tested this on. When the array fit in the L1, we had this low time per access when I timed that loop, and it crept up as we got to the different caches and eventually to every access needing to go to main memory. Now, we don't observe access times like this on real programs because, well, real programs don't look like the program I wrote. They don't access memory in a random order. They instead take advantage of locality. And the idea of locality, we have these two pieces of locality that we care about. So one is this idea that I told you caches are going to keep recent values. And the assumption we're making is that if my program accesses a value now, it's going to access that value again soon. And second assumption we make is that if my program accesses a value, it's going to access adjacent values soon. And both of these are just natural properties of programs. But we don't have to write programs that way. Like the program I wrote to produce this graph doesn't have that property. Like it deliberately accesses something and doesn't access it again from the array. It deliberately doesn't try to order its accesses in the array in a way which has adjacent things be accessed close in time. It does it in a random order. It doesn't have any of these properties. But real programs do. And this is because of how you typically write programs. So let's think about a loop. So you have a whole bunch of locality here. So one example of locality is that this loop here has machine code. And that machine code is accessed over and over and over again. That's an example of good locality. And so if we want this loop to execute quickly, we want that machine code to be in some fast memory, and that's in fact what will happen. It will be in some fast cache, and that's why fetching each instruction won't take forever. We also have good spatial locality, because that machine code has lots of little instructions. The machine code for each of those instructions is right next to each other in memory. You know, we don't just like jump around randomly. When we're executing this code, it's some nice compact piece of assembly that turns into a nice compact piece of machine code. So as long as our cache loads, you know, not just this instruction, but you know, the next 16 bytes of memory or something like that, it's going to get the other instructions we need for free. We also have locality and values here. So like total I and length, we access over and over again. So those have good locality. And if for some reason we kept them in memory and not in registers, those would all be stuff that we get stored in our cache because they'd be recently accessed every time we tried to access them after the first time. So it'd all be in the cache. It'd all have that nice fast, that L1 cache speed, you know, down here, nice and quick. We also have good spatial locality. So when we access values I plus one, it's because we just accessed values I. So as long as when we read values I, our cache tends to bring in values around values I, like values I plus one, values I minus one, we're gonna have lots of things be in the cache even though we only read through the values array once. We're gonna be able to take advantage of that faster memory. And if you just write code which has loops like this, you'll just naturally have all sorts of locality from, it's just the way you usually write programs. You have to try, usually, to get bad locality, to get really bad locality. Though there are some data structures which are better or worse, and we'll talk about that in a bit. And locality is something you can think about when writing programs, and if you take 30 through 30, we talk about this more, some more systematic ways of thinking about this, because it really affects performance. So here are two programs where I have a two-dimensional array, and I get very different performance because I flipped the order of I and J. So I have I versus J, I versus J, I versus J. That's only change between the two, and you know it's the difference between 0.3 seconds and 2.3 seconds. And the difference is that here, the way C stores arrays, I'm accessing things which are next to each other over and over again. And here, the way C stores arrays, I'm skipping around in memory. So when I'm accessing things next to each other, I'm taking advantage of the fact that my cache stores values which are close, which are near recently accessed values. And so more of my memory accesses go to this fast cache. And that makes a big real difference in my program's performance. So any questions about this? So locality is something that you can think about when you're making data structures. So one easy example is, what data structure has better locality? So should I have an array, like a vector, or a linked list? Which seems to have better locality. No, yeah.
Linked list.
Okay. Think linked list has better locality. So what were our concepts of locality? We should probably go back to that. So in a linked list, so if we access a value in a linked list in memory, we're using a linked list, we access a value in memory, you know, is that different than an array as far as whether, you know, a particular memory location will be accessed again? Yeah, so how is it different?
It just kind of goes to, like, just points to a memory location. It's not like all in a line.
Okay. So if I'm accessing some element of a linked list, I'm going to use pointers, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have more values in my linked list if I'm like iterating through it than I access. So you might say, okay, that's a little better. How about spatial locality? Okay. Yeah, so for a linked list, if I'm iterating through a linked list, I look at the next and previous of the node I'm currently at. Those are things which are adjacent in memory. but everything else isn't. And an array, when I'm looking at the next element, it's adjacent in memory. And this means that generally linked lists have pretty poor locality. So if we think of a linked list, I have 1 through 10 stored in the linked list. Well, when I can, you know, it's wherever malloc put it. So I jump around in memory. So if I'm iterating through this, I'm going to access 1, then 2, then 3, then 4. Versus with the array, I'm accessing 1, then 2, then 3, then 4. And so that generally means that linked lists have worse locality. And if you think about temporal locality, it's not actually much different. You might say, oh, if I have to get the nth item of the linked list, I'm going to short access this a lot. But that's sort of an asymptotic efficiency difference. Like with an array, if you get the nth item, it's fast. With a linked list, you wouldn't, you know, it's slow. But probably if you're using a linked list, you're not trying to get the nth item, just because you know that it involves reading that next pointer over and over again. Even though reading that will be fast with caches, assuming you have a small list, because it will be accessed frequently, like accessing more stuff is not going to make your program faster, even if it improves the locality. So this is one example where arrays have this much better locality. And this means that in practice, even though Big O says linked lists and arrays are about the same, in practice you often see a big performance gain from using something like arrays because you get much better locality in cases where even in cases where we aren't concerned about accessing the nth item. It's obviously not a Big O difference, it's not an asymptotic difference, but it's a real difference that matters on modern machines. So another big example of locality in data structures is trees versus hash tables. So who has an opinion about which ones of these have better locality? Trees or hash tables? Yeah.
Hash tables, probably.
Why hash tables?
Because with hash tables, you only have to access this one segment of memory, whereas with trees, you would have to access multiple nodes.
Okay, so your argument is hash tables, well, I have less memory accesses, so maybe that's better. So let's say I'm accessing things in like order, in some sorted order. Which one is going to be better for locality? Trees or hash tables? You know, I have a list, I'm looking up list which is sorted, I'm looking at thing up in a search tree or a hash table, yeah.
Trees, because with the hash table, the next sequential item might not be right next to it.
Yeah, so with a hash table, if I happen to be keys up in some roughly sorted order, I'm not going to get much benefit from locality. The related keys are going to be randomly distributed throughout the hash table, I hope. With the tree, I'm going to have the same first few tree nodes, and I'll get better locality. So it depends on what accesses you're doing. So a hash table has better asymptotic efficiency. We just do less memory accesses, typically. But if we have a relationship between consecutive nodes we're accessing, then we might get locality with a tree, and we won't get it with a hash table. And that's a reason why you might see some practical data structures. You might get better performance from trees, because they are a case where you might have locality, especially if you think about things like splay trees, which also reorganize the tree to take advantage of the same principle. Okay. So I guess I'll finish up on this slide. So a big reason why we care about locality is what's happened to CPU performance versus memory performance. So CPUs have been getting faster and faster until we kind of leveled off around 2010. And memory, hasn't really. So we have this big gap between the amount of time it takes to access memory and the amount of time it takes to say do a single calculation one at a time on a CPU. And this means that more so than before, locality really matters. And that's where we'll pick up next time. Oh, yeah, I probably should. Thank you.